Making love may be the biggest bait and switch scheme of recorded and unrecorded history. You know what bait and switch is. When one thing's advertised, but you're really being sold something else, usually something far more expensive. You think you're making love. Okay, maybe you think you're making a baby. But I can state with confidence that at no time in the history of humankind did a lover ever say to his or her partner, when the lights are down low, in the candlelight, with soft music in the background, perfume in the air, sherry in your glasses, honey, we love each other so much, let's make a teenager. I can just imagine this mythical conversation. Oh, darling, won't it be wonderful? The arguments, the pleas to clean up his room, the dates she'll bring home, the skimpy clothes that she'll want to wear to school, the music that will blare through our home, the makeups, the piercings, the tattoos, the car insurance payments. Gee, honey, your wife dreamily wonders, maybe if we're especially lucky, we'll have three daughters, and we can all share that special time of the month together. Did you ever hear such a conversation? I didn't think so. Bait and switch, I say. Yes, where, I ask, was it ever disclosed that we were making a 2-year-old? Making a 12-year-old who thinks she's a 22-year-old? Making an adolescent? Making a 16-year-old who can legally get behind the wheels of a car? Making a 35-year-old who acts like a 12-year-old? You get the picture? I have a confession. During one especially trying time in the history of raising our children, I thought of creating a new organization. I would call it the Right to a Life Society. We would stand outside fertility clinics and beg couples not to take this fateful step. We could have large pictures of our teenagers' rooms and implore them, save yourselves! You don't have to do this! But of course, I would never seriously contemplate such a thing, especially as your rabbi. Having children is the most powerful, meaningful, maturing, deepening, life-affirming, rewarding, inspiring, and perspiring thing I have ever done. It has been the source of some of the greatest joy and happiness in my life, as well as the source of some of the deepest pain and anguish. And I should say this is true not only for biological children. Much of what I have to say applies to those of us who have played important roles in helping to raise nieces and nephews, grandchildren, and even students and children of friends. Having children is the most life-changing experience that has happened to me. I always tease couples that I meet in the glow of new pregnancy, that this is the least reversible thing you can do in your life. Anything else can be changed, but you never cease being the parent of your child. I can remember having conversations with a mother who is 95 years old, worrying about her 65-year-old daughter. After this, after being a parent, nothing is the same. The way you eat, sleep, work, vacation, talk, love, relate, worry, especially worry. I always tell these couples, write down today a list of the things you are currently worried about. Because I guarantee you, once you have a child, you will be asking yourselves, what did we ever worry about before we had a child? Becoming a parent reveals a new side to you. As your patience, tolerance, temper, sense of humor, ability to withstand sleep deprivation, and sense of self-worth is tested. You know, you may be a Phi Beta Kappa PhD, but for a long time you'll be hereinafter known as Noah's daddy. I never met anyone who was indifferent about their children. Love, yes. Resentment, yes. Anger bordering on hate, yes. Quelling pride, yes. Disappointment, yes. But I've never heard anyone say, oh yeah, my son Yanko. I wonder whatever happened to him. I haven't heard from him in years. Maybe I should look him up. The subject of this sermon is unexpected and unintended consequences of having children. I want to discuss the things that are unexpected and wonderful, maybe chuckle with you over the things that we might not describe as so wonderful, and dwell in some depth at some of the impacts that are as amazing as they are unexpected. Think about the risk and courage relating to having to the decision of having a child. At some level, you know that you don't know what you're getting into. Yet you proceed. These days, with such easy access to pregnancy prevention and even pregnancy termination, most of our children and grandchildren are the result of a conscious decision to enter parenthood. And in fact, in many cases, the result of a long effort to become pregnant. Judaism and Jewish tradition have a lot to say on the subject of having children, and virtually all of it is positive. The first commandment in the Torah is Pru Uvru, be fruitful and multiply. The model of God's relationship with Israel is that of a parent and child. We call God Avinu, our Father. Tonight, as I mentioned, Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary not of the birth of the world, but of the birth of humanity. I like to think that God too entered into that divine relationship with humanity as God's partner, with some of the same spirit of caution, trepidation, worry, confidence, and optimism that the experiment would work out for the best in the long run. I wonder what God would say are the unintended consequences of this relationship. Let's look at what Judaism says about parenting from some of our sacred texts, from the Talmud. The Talmud instructs us that we have the obligation to teach our children Torah, a trade, and how to swim, as well as seeing that they marry. A man once complained to the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidic Judaism, about his son. The youth had turned completely away from religion, a great blow to his father. "What shall I do, Rebbe?" said the distraught man. Do you love your son?" "Of course I do." "Then love him even more." Do we think we are the first parents to agonize and worry about our children? Look at what the Talmud warned us about daughters some 1,500 years ago, about how daddy would worry. When she's a child, he worries that she'll be seduced. As an adolescent, that she'll be promiscuous. As an adult, that she won't get married. As a married woman, that she won't have children. And when she grows old, that she'll engage in witchcraft. Yet the greatest blessing the Talmud can conceive for a righteous scholar is not fame, fortune, or even more learning, but that he or she have a child like him or herself. Perhaps the most infamous commentary on parenting is that dealing with the stubborn and rebellious son. We actually read this from the Torah scroll a few weeks ago, from the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, "If a man has a stubborn or rebellious son who does not heed his father or mother, and does not obey them even after they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of this town at the public place of this community. They shall say to the elders of the town, 'This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He does not heed our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard.' Thereupon the men of the town shall stone him to death." Now I know some of you are rushing to make notes and quote me to your children. But the Talmud systematically makes this process and procedure impossible. I spoke about how our rabbis proved that the Torah really didn't mean to be so harsh and eliminated this mitzvah from our tradition. You could, in fact, say that the Torah, particularly the book of Genesis, is an excellent text on parenting. What you see there, don't do. The very first two brothers, Cain, murders Abel. Abraham participates in the near sacrifice of both of his sons. Isaac is tricked into switching his blessing from Esau to Jacob with the co-conspiracy of his wife Rachel. Laban switches brides on Jacob. Jacob favors Joseph and destroys his family and causes the Egyptian slavery. You know, traditionally, when a parent blesses his children or her children, when they bless their daughter, the prayer is that she be like Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel, our matriarchs. But when they bless their sons, it's not Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The prayer is that they be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's a real puzzle. Why Ephraim and Manasseh? These are Joseph's two sons. They're mentioned. We don't know much about them. And I think they're the only brothers, possibly in the Torah, that don't seem to hate each other. The title of this sermon is Unexpected and Even Unintended Consequences of Having Children. So first, the expected and intended consequences. Having a baby, fulfilling yourself, your role, the natural consequence of completing your nest, your home, is to fill it. Having the experience of parenting, beating the biological clock for some of us. There is joy in decorating the room, buying the clothes, buying the toys, especially for the grandparents. There's a sense of preserving your name and your family, of being parents like your parents, of keeping up with your friends, siblings, other family, of becoming a mature adult, fulfilling your destiny, but also becoming like a child again. Yes, you get to go back to Disneyland to once again see it through your child's eyes. But now the unintended and unexpected consequences. In the interest of time, I will skip the unintended consequences of the pregnancy itself. Physical, hormonal, emotional, financial, and hysterical. The baby, him or herself, if not planned, is surely an unintended consequence. But please note that this does not preempt or eliminate any of the other unintended consequences below. The birth itself, the idea of birth is intended, but the details, the dash to the hospital, the time that you were in labor, you know, all the good parts of the story that you tell and retell are not so planned. The pain involved with labor, and here, of course, I'm talking about the pain of the husband. The mother's pain is understood at least on an intellectual level. My favorite quote is from Carol Burnett, who once said, if a man wants to experience the pain of childbirth, try grabbing your lower lip and pulling it up over your head. But we never talk about the father's pain. One of the things they didn't tell me in Lamaze is the first thing you do is cut your wife's nails when she goes into labor. We were both panting. And let's not forget the father's psychic pain. During my late wife's birth of our daughter, she wanted to be put out. The nurses are telling me, you know, this was natural childbirth, Lamaze, don't worry, they all say this. She's saying, Michael, I want to be out. And I thought she was going to leave me. The marriage was over. I had never seen her so angry. Yet minutes later, cooing and gooing. Unbelievable. With this new child, many things slowly or quickly dawn on you. These are irreversible changes in your life and your priorities. You become aware of an immense responsibility that this small life now depends upon you. That there is no substitute for you in the relationship. And that this will never end. Today it's changing her diaper. 3 years from now it will be kissing the boo-boo. 10 years from now it will be supporting her self-esteem. 25 years from now it will be planning her wedding. 30 years from now will be advice on raising her own children. 35 years from now it may be a relationship crisis. But she will always, always look to you as mom or dad. The intensity of love, attachment, and protectiveness was for me overwhelming. When my first child was born, he was born with some strange condition. He was incredibly anemic. And it took a day or so for them to figure out that this was a temporary problem and not a lifelong crisis. That was the worst day of my life. And of course, this incredible bond doesn't end in infancy. As I've discussed with you, there is no pain as intense as seeing the pain of your children hurting. And this is true whether you are 25 or 85. As someone once said, a parent is rarely happier than his or her most unhappy child. And so our children become a constant focus, the never-ending background music accompanying our lives. For better or for worse, we never stop thinking about them. This is, I think, the real key to my principal point. In giving life to this new life, we may just find out that a new life has been given to us. In giving life to this new life, we may just find out that a new life has been given to us. And here I'm not talking about your new life as a milk machine, money machine, carpooler, tutor, nurse, disciplinarian, coach, research assistant, man or maid servant. I'm talking about your life as redefined. What really stimulated this sermon were conversations I've had with people, especially women, over the last few years. Women who were in serious, death-defying battles for their lives, particularly battles with cancer. I know that there is not a person in this room who does not know something about cancer or chemotherapy. As you will often hear, the treatment can sometimes seem as awful as the disease. And many choose not to subject themselves to this deliberate poisoning of their body to gain some extra time on earth. But the women I spoke with, each of them, told me that there were times that they felt that death would be preferable to another course of chemo or radiation or surgery or all three. They had no choice, they said, but to survive for the sake of their children. One said she could not surrender to cancer because it would rob her of seeing her daughters graduate college and marry. Another spoke of the need to see her grandchildren, bar and bat mitzvah, while a third couldn't bear to miss the marriage of her grandchildren. It struck me so powerfully. These children and their own children were in no small way responsible for saving their mother's lives. I mean this literally. I remember my own crisis as my world collapsed around me, as my late wife succumbed to a genetic disease. I remember the temptation to escape in any way that might work, to run away to a different place, to drugs, to alcohol, to gambling, to anything that might anesthetize me to the pain that I knew would exist for years to come. I remember crying endlessly. I mean this literally. I remember crying my heart out and thinking, I will never be able to stop crying. After all, in 20 minutes, in 20 hours, in 20 days, weeks, or years, the pain will still be there. I remember thinking, that's the reason I'm crying will never disappear. How can I stop crying? Now, I knew that intellectually at that time, in all likelihood, I would not really spend the rest of my life crying, or even the rest of that afternoon crying. But the thought didn't help so much. I'll tell you what helped. The thought of what would my children do if I fell apart? On whom would they rely? Who will be there to help them, to share their pain and their joy, if not me? The same powerful connection I felt to my one-day-old baby 41 years ago kept me attached to my children, to my sanity, and to my life. As parents, we participate in the mystery and miracle of creating a new life. It's hard to know or remember what our thoughts, plans, and expectations were back then when we were creating these precious lives. But I do know that none of us ever thought that these sweet, innocent, fragile, helpless, and adorable souls that we brought into the world might someday give us the strength and resolve to keep our own lives on track. Tonight, at the start of the days of awe, we begin the time when we examine our own weaknesses and our own mortality. We are commanded to recognize and name our sins and seek out those we've hurt to ask forgiveness. In thinking about whom you need to talk to about forgiveness, please don't forget your children. Apologize to them for all the times you were too strict, unfair, impatient, too busy, too angry with them. Some amazing doors can open if you have the courage to admit your error and your fallibility to your children. In doing so, you give them an important lesson on how they will treat your grandchildren. But even as we will give up the blessings of our normal lives for the 24 hours of Yom Kippur, just 10 days from today, I encourage you to count your blessings. Judaism recognizes that parenting is not just a biological phenomenon. You can be the spiritual parent of a niece, nephew, student, or even child in your neighborhood. Being a parent means someone is irrevocably connected to you and your life. That Ruach Elohim, a divine spirit, the divine spirit that first hovered over the face of the deep before the moment of creation, flows between the two of you. I suggest to you that it is this Ruach that animates the divine in each of you. It is this Ruach that adds the dimension of death to your lives. It is this Ruach that makes you and your children simultaneously human and fallible and divine and immortal. May the spiritual and physical cleansing of the high holy days refresh and renew your bodies and your souls. May you have the health to enjoy this next year, surrounded by those you love, and the courage and spirit to love those who surround you. Yom Kippur especially is a day to dwell on our mortality. We have a special service of Yizkor, of remembrance. We remember those who parented us and who parented our parents. We remember these sacred relationships, and we think about what we might have done or said if we had a bit more time. Our tradition teaches that this powerful act of memory should lead us back to life with a determination to heal those relationships that can still be healed and strengthened. Now, today, is that time. Don't leave it off for another year. L'shana tova tikatevim. May you be inscribed for a good year. And gemar chatima tova. May you be sealed for a good year in the book of life.